It's a great pleasure to welcome back to WFMT Leonard Slatkin. Back to, well, if you were listening just a few days ago, then you might think he's on every few days. But he's on as often as he can be when he's in town because he is a conductor and a figure in the American musical landscape. And we're going to hear a little bit, too, about his role as a figure in the French musical landscape and Russian and other places. But we are particularly happy to have Leonard Slatkin with us now, both for the reasons that have brought him back to Chicago and also because of the role he has been playing in the rebirth of a great American orchestra and a great American city. I'm speaking in both of those latter instances of Detroit. But I also want to mention that he is here because he is returning 40th anniversary year to conduct the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And if you're listening to us on Monday night, the 21st, you actually have one more evening that you can hear the concert Tuesday at 7:30, an All-American program. We'll talk about that in a moment. You will have missed the very interesting benefit that he has conducted with the Dempster Street Pro Musica and the Chamber Music Society of St. Louis to benefit the Schulte Foundation U.S., say that 10 times, and we'll also allude to that, but we want to thank the foundation and we want to thank Michael Hennock and his colleagues of Dempster Street for making Mr. Slatkin available to us. Wow, what a long introduction. But now we're going to get into the meat, which is going to be talking with Leonard Slatkin. Welcome. Welcome back to Chicago, which I always think of you as a Chicago connected conductor, if nothing else, because you were at Grant Park for several summers, and you've been playing with the CSO at least since I was 14 years old. Oh, so I think of you as part of the furniture.
Well, Chicago is always a very special place. And when I first started coming here, I was just the assistant conductor in St. Louis. But it was easy enough to come up here. I used to just hop on a plane, come up to watch Maestro Schulte, Giulini, Abbado, all these conductors. And I got to know them. It was a remarkable time. And then when I finally stood on the stage in 1974, it was like, oh, I know this place. Right. I don't need to be scared of it.
Right. And you were three summers ahead of Grant Park?
Yeah. Three.
How did that come about?
I'm not sure, really. I honestly don't know. I remember I got a call from my agent, said they'd like you to be music director at Grant Park. I hadn't conducted one note there. And I said, sure, why not? Perhaps the connection to Chicago that I already established with the CSO.
Right.
At that time, and maybe even to this day, there's still a little bit of, antagonism. You don't see people on the Ravinia podium going downtown to Orchestra Hall and vice versa.
Right, right.
And it certainly applied back then. This was at the time when Ed Gordon had just left.
Ed Gordon had left Grant Park and gone to Ravinia.
Right. And Stanley Ackerman was taking over in Grant Parks. But I think they felt Chicago audiences already knew me a little bit, mm-hmm. and that it would be a good idea to do that. And I thought it would look, what's better? I go to a Chicago city that I love,
right.
and I get to do pretty much anything that I wanted to do. There was no restriction on the repertoire at all.
Right. Right.
The only problem was it was just two rehearsals for every concert.
Right.
And when I look back and see the kind of pieces we played, I don't know how we did it, but we did.
Yeah, and they continue that and building on what you did and Hugh Wolfe and others. Carlos Kalmar is mm-hmm. practically permanent there, at least for yep. his summers. And you can't believe the programming.
I mean,
I not mean to put words in anyone else's mouth, but compared to what goes on in Highland Park in the summer, there's just no comparison. And they're still doing it on those two rehearsals.
Yep, and it's still for free for the audience.
That's
unlike
thing.
Any place right. in this country. You can't find anything comparable. So what a great treat for the music-loving public.
And when you add that location, now this will be your
first
this
time.
Summer you're going to be back, and Hugh will also be back, so all of the living music directors or principal conductors. And you're going to be there for the first time in the Pritzker Pavilion and in this amazing setting. You're going to, even though I know you were knocked out plenty, of audience members with great concerts when you're here, I think you're going to find this particularly special. What are you playing?
It's an interesting program because it's a mixture of things. The first half includes the Chicago premiere of a piano concerto by a very good friend of mine who's playing. His name is Michel Camillo. He's known very well in the jazz community, but he's studied with Jacob Latiner at Juilliard, and his classical credentials are strong. But this guy is just the knockout pianist. I mean, he's just going to tear the house down.
And he's going to, he is the composer and the performer.
And the pianist. Something you don't see so much anymore today.
Right.
It was more of a product of the 19th century and early 20th.
Right. So Rachmaninoff, Anton Rubinstein,
Chopin,
those guys. Yeah.
So this is throwback. It's not a jazz piece. It has jazz influence in it. Mm-hmm. It's called Tenerife, based on the Canary Islands, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's a terrific showpiece. So that's on the program, but also a piece that I introduced to Chicago during my Grand Park years, a cantata by Shostakovich called The Execution of Stenka Razan, which I think is a spectacular piece with a story about the head of the slaves basically being chopped off, and then the Tsar can't close its eyes. And it's terrifying, but it's wonderful Shostakovich.
And with all the Shostakovich that has re-entered and become constant in the repertoire, this piece is still a real rarity.
It's a rarity probably because it's a choral work to start with. And the second thing is you need an outstanding baritone soloist. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll be okay. I don't know, other than people telling me this is the guy you want for it.
Right. Well, you certainly will have an outstanding chorus, the Grant Park Chorus, which always was great with Tom Peck and then Michael Cullen.
I stole Tom Peck and brought
him
to
St.
Louis.
That's right.
I mean, he still continued to do both.
Right,
but
right.
Tom was the one who brought the St. Louis chorus. He founded them and got them to an incredible level.
An absolute master.
Tom was great.
And what a time it was in Chicago that you had the there was also, of course, Robert Shaw. No one could put him down, but he was also many other things and orchestral connect. But you had the two great chorus creator builders, Margaret Hillis and Thomas Peck, right across the street from each other. That was a glory time.
It really was.
There's a glory time going on, and I'm not saying that facetiously at all, in Detroit, Michigan. And the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, which seemed to some, at least outside of the city, to be, quote unquote, a part of the problem, not only wasn't, but has become, in the eyes of everybody, including the just received Pulitzer Prize winner yesterday for commentary from the Detroit paper, it's part of the solution.
It is.
Walk us back through you and Detroit and then what was going on there.
To really go back, when I left Washington 6 years ago, my intention was not to take another orchestra. I really thought, that's it. I'm done. I've run two of them.
17 years in St. Louis.
12
years in the National Symphony in Washington.
And then I guest conducted the orchestra. I hadn't been there in 30 years. Mm. So the prior appearance was in something called Ford Auditorium, close to the riverfront. Now they were back in Old Orchestra Hall, which was built in 1912, and it was demanded to be built by Osip Gabrilovich. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm not coming there unless you build me the hall, and they did. And it's a gem. It's not a big hall. It only seats about 1,600 or so people.
Oh, that's nice.
And the sound is one of the most extraordinary of any hall I've ever encountered in the world. Mm. It defines the orchestra. Any hall should, of course. And we hit it off. It was really good. I didn't really think that there was a vacancy, but then they asked me. They said, Jarvi had already been gone for 4 years. Mm-hmm. There was no one. They hadn't found the right person, but this worked. The good thing was that the economic problems of not only the orchestra but the city were laid out to me.
Right.
And it was kind of like saying, here's the problem. Do you want to be part of this? A lot of people said, you don't want to do this. It's going to be a mess. But after all these years of doing what I do, I came to realize that I'm actually good in a situation where problems need to be solved. It's a strength.
I think of you as a problem solver.
Yeah. So, I'll be 70 in a couple of months. When you get to this point, you become not just realistic, but you understand everything you need to know about your strengths and your weaknesses. And as soon as I knew what the problems were, and everybody already told me there was going to be a strike, we already knew that, I said, I can help here. So we started. And then in the third year, well, several things happened. The first year, I only had 5 weeks to give, so I really didn't do much in Detroit. Mm-hmm. The second year, I had a heart attack. That wasn't fun.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. So I was out for 3 months. So that didn't count. And then the third year, there was no third year. The city, which had begun economic decline probably in 2005 or six, well ahead of the 2008 downturn, now was in horrible shape. Even though we're not a city-sponsored organization, we're all private, donations were down. People had lost sometimes 70, 75% of their portfolios. The auto industry was failing. People who you could always rely on for contributions no longer existed, or they had ceased to give money. And the orchestra went on strike. It was a contentious time. Mm-hmm. Very, very difficult. And the music director's job, in my opinion anyway, is to stay out of it. Do not get publicly involved in this. And I didn't. But I did work behind the scenes, both with musicians, with board of directors, and with the management. And the reason I did that is I said, I need to have a handle on what we're going to do when this is over. And as predicted, it was 6 months, mm-hmm. almost to the day. Mm-hmm. So it ended. And at that point, both me and the staff and orchestra put into place a whole bunch of initiatives that would take place. The orchestra during the strike did the right thing. They played out in the suburbs where our money is. Mm-hmm. They played in temples. They played in schools. They played in hospitals. So we took that on. And now we play a series of four concerts each in seven different locations. What does it mean? 3,000 new subscribers. Mm-hmm. Second thing, simple, economics. We had been suffering with about 60 to 64% attendance. Why? People couldn't afford to go, especially young people. Not that we were overpriced, but just not in this market. So we instituted several things, and the most interesting, I think, was something that I brought from my orchestra in Lyon. That's called a sound card. Basically, you spend $25 2 weeks before any performance, and I mean any performance in the hall, not just the orchestra, anything that's going on. If there's a ticket available, you're in. And people went, Slatkin, that's crazy. It doesn't make any economic sense. I said, yes, it does. It makes sense for many reasons, one of which is that you're going to fill seats that would have been empty. Second thing, it's only $25 for the whole year. You buy, you just get one ticket, and you've already paid for that sound card, just like that. And the third thing, it's going to put young people in the seats.
And that is so important for so many reasons. Go ahead.
Anyway, the end of this story is that now, at a Detroit Symphony concert, you see approximately 90 to 93% of the hall full. And you look out in that audience, diversity is there. Age groups have changed. The ethnic makeup of our city is quite diverse, like Chicago. And you look out there and you see this going on and people getting vitally interested.
And if you, we're going to come to it in a little bit, but if you have the opportunity and you actually have it any time to log on to the webcasts, which Detroit is the hemispheric pioneer. It's Berlin Phil versus Detroit
Symphony
Orchestra.
Well, no, it's not because we offer it for free.
Aha, that's true. So you win.
Yeah.
Detroit wins.
We win.
But you will see the enthusiastic, large, and diverse audience. One of the things about putting young people in the seats is you also put them in the lobby. You also put people in the seats, and then there's that 10 or 15% bump of people saying, gosh, I guess this is a ticket to buy. Mm-hmm. It's not when we were here and it was 65% attendance.
That's right.
And people get excited
about
it.
People get excited by success. And the other thing I would add to your points, which are certainly the right ones, when those young people are not young people anymore.
Well, that's the, of course, the thing that most people get come to. How can we get that next audience? But there's also the fact that you have a kind of literal shot in the arm, as well as this investment in building a future audience.
As far as the internet broadcasts go, people would have said, well, you know, you're going to dilute your audience. They can just stay at home and watch it for free. And much like the popular music industry, it's not the case at all. It's been exactly the opposite. The webcasts fuel people. Right. To want to come down. You're right. They see the enthusiasm. They see the excitement. They hear what's going on. Yeah, it's tough. It's 21, 22 programs a year that we stream live. And it's difficult, you know. Now we have new robotic cameras that are very cool. Mm-hmm. Can't see the cameraman anymore. Right. And it's enabled us to do other things. And there'll be other things down the line. Our job in Detroit right now is to always keep one step ahead.
Right.
To see what's next. Never to rest on the accomplishment.
And you were doing that very interestingly during that six-month period. You were thinking, you were planning, you were bringing people together. I think you, from an outside point of view, you did, quote, stay out of it in terms of taking sides. But my recollection is that you did make a number of comments, whether they were speeches, answers to questions, where you said, when we're back, we have to be really focused on our communities, right? You were saying
exactly
that
right.
at the time.
Yep.
And in a way, I'm sure that also helped those sides focus on what really meant. Why are we negotiating? Why are we here?
Well, and you can imagine when it was over, if there was still a lot of resentment and antagonism and vitriol. But now here we are 3 years later, after that has ended, and maybe not 100% of it, but certainly 95% of it has disappeared. People who were really the violent people, as it were, on both sides have found a way to come together. There's not one committee, for example, that's board-related where there's not at least one, if not two, members of the orchestra.
So
it's
important.
It's a completely different
So are you
atmosphere.
All going to get on a bus and go to another state that begins with an M that has an orchestra that didn't seem to learn a lot from what all you all did?
Your point is really interesting here. Because every conflict like this, and believe me, these aren't over. We are going to see other disasters happen in this country. And it's that every dispute is local. Every solution that you find has to be geared towards your community. And it's for a very simple reason. Virtually all the orchestras in this country, save for maybe one or two, have the name of either their city or their state in their title. So if you don't take care of things at home first, anything past that is meaningless. Mm-hmm. Our colleagues to the north have a lot of difficulty to go through yet. They're not finished by any means. And they have got to think about, what do we do for all those people who were deprived the music for a year and a half? How can we get to them? It's not just about playing in your hall. It's reaching them in other ways. It's making it available. But they have to find that solution in their way, just like we found it in our way.
Right. But I think and hope, and from talking to musicians, their at least recent board members are not the kind of people I normally run into, but in talking to the musicians, there certainly is a sense that there are lessons to be learned from Detroit, particularly because they're seeing how it's building, not just how you resolved things.
Right, and I know that they've been talking to people in Detroit about it, so they at least have maybe a blueprint and can use some of our ideas to change things in their own way. But it's a tough situation up there right now.
When there is a stoppage, strike, or lockout, as the case may be in each place, there are players who do leave or get recruited elsewhere. How many people did you all lose from the main roster?
Most of our people who we lost retired.
Okay.
To other orchestras, including Chicago, we lost about six players. But in a couple cases, they probably would have gone anyway. Alex Hanna, here's here in Chicago, most likely would have taken
it. I mean, here is a job, principal bass of the Chicago Symphony, that has been open twice in an 80-year period. So it's the combination of the Chicago Symphony, a new music director, and also that job is never going to open up.
You're not going to stop that kind of thing.
Right.
Another player went to be the principal percussionist in Boston.
Right.
Our first cellist went out to be in L.A.
Right.
We can't compete
in
economics. We're not talking about music.
No.
It's not a musical reason here.
Right.
There's some things we just know we're not going to be competitive.
Right.
So what we do now is we do a lot of recruitment and advertising, as it were, for these vacancies. As far as your question, original question goes, how many left? It's a little hard to answer it directly. I'm going to say, because they're retired, I'm going to say that overall, in the last 3 years, we've probably had to replace about 15 people.
Okay. Tell us about the people who've come in.
Well, our new concertmaster, and we did lose three people to the Dallas Symphony, who really made a big pitch to get them, and they did. And one was the concertmaster, but she didn't leave to become concertmaster in Dallas. She sits on the second stand inside. She was so angry and so hostile about what was happening in Detroit. She just had to get out of there. Well, so she did.
Well, the new concert, almost for health reasons, you could
almost,
say.
Almost. And I understand that.
Right.
Our new concertmaster, Yunxin Song, was in the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, which, of course, was going through its own crisis.
Right.
And so she came to us, and she's just been an amazing, amazing discovery. She played the Brahms with us last year, which is what she auditioned with. And it was as good as almost every soloist I've ever played.
Mm-hmm.
So she's there. We have a new first oboist coming in, new first clarinet. The new first flute comes to us from Los Angeles, actually.
Right.
David Buck was in the LA Philharmonic,
right.
And he came to us.
Right.
New principal percussion, I forget where he comes from. They're coming, in some cases, from schools, in some cases, from other orchestras. So we're getting a combination of experience and people who need to learn.
And I mean, that's just tremendously exciting.
We didn't think that it was going to be quite as, I don't want to say easy, but we really felt, all of us, that one of the difficulties would be how would people react when saying, do you want to come to Detroit? Oh, we heard what happened in Detroit. We don't want to be there.
Right.
So we've gone out of our way to really let people know that there are a lot of opportunities. We provide chamber music opportunities, teaching opportunities, communication opportunities, and all that can be done making the job itself more interesting for the player.
And a number of the people who did take unique opportunities elsewhere have made it very clear then and since that it wasn't Detroit.
No.
Alex Hanna, anytime he gives an interview, talks about, I loved the orchestra. I actually loved the town. I loved the area. I loved where I was teaching. This was just a different special opportunity.
Yeah, I understand that.
But I think that's important to hear from somebody after he or she makes a move, rather than especially when a city has been the butt of jokes and criticism
right.
That's almost always from people who've never even visited it.
Sure. We got, when I first arrived, you thought Cleveland was bad. Go to Detroit.
Right.
But on the other hand, when you go to Detroit now, there is this energy in the city. It's quite remarkable. I've seen it already happen in such a short time. Businesses
right.
that have moved in, young people from around the country coming there because they can afford to live in
right.
Detroit.
You have artists moving into Detroit from Florida, from China, from New York, from Brooklyn, for the same reason that 20, 25 years ago they started doing that in Chicago.
That's right.
Because it's affordable and it's navigable, and that's going to build and build, I
also,
think.
Also, because you don't have the kind of pressure that you have in some other metropolitan areas.
Mm-hmm.
You're not having to be competitive
right.
with other organizations or cities. You can grow in your own way. One of our goals in Detroit, anyway, is to see, can we retain these young talents we have? I don't think anybody enters the orchestra profession anymore as a young person going, okay, I'm going to take this job and I'm going to stay there for the rest of my life.
Right. It's
but
changed.
What we're going to do is to make sure that at least for the time they are there, they have the opportunity to do what they want to do. And maybe that helps keep them a bit longer.
We're speaking with Leonard Slatkin, who is music director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra and was, of course, famed as music director both in St. Louis and in Washington, D.C., together totaling almost 30 years and has a 40-year career, not every single day,
no.
but frequently in Chicago and, of course, every orchestra, major orchestra in the country and many major orchestras and opera houses around the world. And we're going to talk a bit about France as we go along, but we are still with the French city, Detroit, in the straits
yes.
there of eastern Michigan, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more still, because at least I find it a fascinating and a hopeful subject. Are there formal or informal gatherings, alliances, or whatever between the symphony, the opera, the famed art museum, the other cultural, which has its own
yeah.
difficulties, but at least so far, the right people are standing up and saying we're going to
yeah.
do everything we can to preserve this museum.
We should tell people who are not clued in, the bankruptcy that has been declared for Detroit, which frankly was critical to the solution. I mean, it had to undergo this. You had to get rid of 60 years of mismanagement, corruption, and all that stuff that was going on. The problem that affected the museum was very simple. The city owns the museum
right.
and supposedly the artwork as well. You would have to go to every donor and see what the original agreement was as to really who's. So that's why this is going to be tied up for years,
right,
and most likely will not result in a sell-off of the art. That's not
right.
I don't
think
that's.
And we should point out, it is truly a great museum. Yeah. It has been entirely restored, renovated, and refurbished. It has a great director in Graham Beal, who was just speaking in Chicago this last week, and a very, very positive outlook. Bankruptcy court is complicated. Municipal bankruptcies are complicated. Throw in a 100-plus-year-old museum filled with masterworks. It's complicated. But go and see the DIA.
Oh, yeah. And how are you going to even think to sell off the murals of Diego Rivera?
Right.
How are they going to do that? It can't. It's not possible.
And they are for that space.
For that
they
space.
Are about industry. They are about the history of America and of the automobile. But how do you all, the artists, do you all come together? Do you all compare notes?
We certainly compare notes. Right. We don't collaborate probably as much as we should.
Mm-hmm.
The opera theaters, who just named a new executive director in Wayne Brown, who used to work for the NEA. That's good. That's
right.
A good appointment.
Right.
After all of fine years of David Di Chiara.
Right.
It's a kind of smaller operation, really. We've talked about trying to merge forces for some productions here and there. Some people talk about, well, should the two organizations actually be together? Probably not yet, but maybe at some point.
Is it more comparable? And I know there's a difference in the concentrated season in St. Louis, but is it somewhat comparable in terms of size, Opera Theater St. Louis and the St. Louis Symphony, or Opera Theater is bigger?
Well, Opera Theater is only in the summer
June.
Months,
yeah.
June
yeah.
and July period.
Right.
The season of the Michigan Opera Theater is over the course of the winter season. I think they do four, maybe five productions now.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's not really like that at all. And what happens is that the orchestra that plays for the opera also does all the shows that come in, like Lion King or whatever it happens to be.
Right.
So the last thing we want to do is take away a contract from anybody who already exists.
Right.
That's not a good idea.
Yeah.
But certainly we do things like say, okay, what are you presenting? Because now we're beginning this thing of an opera and concert each year. Not always the usual suspects. We started it this year with Dum Dee Tweedle of David Del Tredici.
Oh, wow.
That was our first opera and concert.
Wow. I wanted to get up there for that, and the dates just didn't work.
Yeah. So the Art Museum, we have a very good relationship, and we do chamber music concerts there. But at our hall, Orchestra Hall, we actually have three facilities. There's a second hall called the Music Box and a smaller one called Alice. And we've started putting on presentations in those places, which are helping to generate revenue. And people are coming down to them. They really are.
Right.
It's very exciting. But I think we should do more within the city with the other arts institutions.
How about with the schools? Do you
a
have
lot.
Formal relationships
Absolutely.
With the schools?
Absolutely. And we'll probably take on some of the schools as being special partners.
Mm-hmm.
If you are in the back of the hall where the stage entrance is, and you literally go just on the other side of that alley, there's something called the Detroit School of the Arts, which is a charter school.
Right.
And we've really made great strides in trying to get the two organizations to work together. That's 500 kids over there.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them very talented, specializing in theater, recording, dance, music, whatever. So this school makes sense for us to do more with. We do a lot of educational events. We do a lot of community outreach. We do what we think we have to do.
Right. So here we're seeing the way an orchestra is recognizing, in part from insight and prodding from somebody who has known national orchestras in regional places throughout his career, Leonard Slatkin, but this idea that we need to solve things locally, we need to work locally, but we also need not to hide under a bushel.
Right.
I mean, you're webcasting for the world, yeah. not just for Detroit.
Well, it's interesting because when we first thought of this idea, obviously the first thing was, well, this is going to cost too much. Cost the musicians, cost the cameras, all that. So we made an application to a couple of foundations, and they said, it sounds like a really good idea. We'll fund it.
Mm-hmm.
Public television came on board in terms of providing the camera support, technical support that we needed. And over the 3 years that we've been doing it now, we've taken more of the production on ourselves at this point. So it's we still sometimes look like a little bit of a, you know, okay, this it's not a New York style production. Right. Yes, okay, that happens. And we have problems sometimes with our cutaway shots and all that. But the sound is good now.
The sound is great.
Sound is great. The website is dso.org.
Right.
But if you want to go and watch a broadcast, you have to go to dso.org/live.
So dso.org, DetroitSymphonyOrchestra.org, will take you to the overall website. And from there, you can then go
or
you can go directly to dso.org/live.
The next one must be this week? I don't know.
Well,
I'm here. I don't know what they're doing in Detroit this week.
The full schedule is up there, and it is an enviable schedule. And that allows us now to kind of move into another part of discussion, and that's always fascinating with Leonard Slatkin, and that's repertoire, because you are a voluntary champion of American music among the rest of the repertoire. And we were just talking a bit before you came on the air about your program in Chicago. In particular, you were telling me that William Schumann's Sixth Symphony, which was written, I believe, in 1949, it was written in the 1940s, just after the war, mm-hmm. is being played in Chicago by the CSO for the first time.
Yeah.
How did we get to a situation where works of Schumann, Sessions, Copland,
Harris,
Morton Gould,
Piston,
Harris,
and this is Gould's 100th year.
Of course, there are the Copland pieces that have become necessary in various contexts, but they're particular pieces. But it's not an overall examination.
I've been thinking about this a lot. Primarily because the state of performances of living composers is actually quite good. You know, names like a John Adams, a Mason Bates, Anna Klein, Chris Rouse, John Corigliano, Joan Tower, Higdon. I mean, the list is quite substantial
and
now.
John Luther Adams.
And Sam Adams, John's son.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It doesn't stop. and beer.
Right.
So what seems to have happened is that when David Daltreci kind of started this revolution in 76 with Final Alice and composers, well, Rockberg was in on it, a few others, but they saw this opportunity to break away from the academic traditions that had been in place for the last 20 years or so. And now they were starting to reach the audiences. So you don't see as much fear if a new piece is there. But what happened was, in the desire to jump on the next hot composer bandwagon, pretty much all of our traditional music went flying away, and it doesn't exist. And it's sad because there are only a handful of us now who knew these composers.
Right.
It's me, Mike Thomas, Zinman, Marin knew a couple, Spano knew a couple. But there are not many of us who really had this firsthand experience. And we were more than anxious to let other people know about this music. So when I was asked to come back this season, the idea of doing a big Bill Schumann symphony, I'd already done a couple of them here.
Right.
And I think a choral work I did of his on Freedom's Ground.
Right.
So I felt comfortable playing his music in Chicago. And I've done Piston and others here over the years. So I wanted to do something on the with the program that was different. Clearly, playing the piece of Mason's made sense. Composer in residence. I premiered it with Anne last season in Pittsburgh.
And so you've recorded it, and that recording is going to be coming out
soon. September.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now I said, how can I pair that? And I thought, I'll put American in Paris on because you need that one piece to help bring the audience in, of course. And then if we have these unusual pieces, I needed also a lighter piece that starts, A School for Scandal, which is such a marvelous piece.
Oh, isn't it? Yeah.
It's his Midsummer Night's Dream Overture, student piece, basically. So I was looking for which Schumann to do. It could have been Menon. It could have been Persichetti. I could have done that. But I just somehow I wanted to do Schumann again.
Right.
And this symphony, which is quite dark and very typical of a sort of assertive Schumann style, every hallmark of his, the polytonality that happens, the use of a timpani solo, the darting figures that happen between strings, winds, and all that. It's very typical. But I find in many ways that this is his most powerful statement in the symphonic form out of the 8 published symphonies that he allowed. And we read through it as we're talking. It would have been on the Tuesday morning, the first rehearsal. And it's hard. There are a lot of notes. And the parts are probably the same ones that were used back in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
So they're not so easy to read. But the orchestra did a superb job. We worked our way through it. And so many of the players came up to say, we don't know anything about this composer or what it is. And to me, that's very sad in this country to have basically ignored what is our symphonic tradition.
Right.
And really, if I was a young conductor starting out, I would go, take a look at this repertoire. You could make a mark here.
Right. Well, that's the exciting side of rediscovery, however wrong or sad it is that it has to be a rediscovery, is that the players are going to be digging into it and the audience is going to be attentive. We're not talking here about quote-unquote scary music, which happens to be music I love, but that wasn't the issue here, as Leonard Slatkin is reminding us. The issue was sort of after battling that the work of these folks get performed because we need living composers, then a bunch of living composers started getting their works performed.
So, you know, another thing that listeners are going to find with all these composers from the past is they do something you very rarely see in today's composers. It's not a criticism. It's just something that's different. They knew how to use counterpoint.
Right.
Man, did they know how to do it.
Talk a little bit more about that and give us some examples.
Counterpoint is that horrible phrase that so many of us had to go through when we were studying harmony and counterpoint. It's not called that anymore. I don't even know what it is. Counterpoint is the best exemplified, say, by Bach, whether it's an invention or a fugue, where you have two or more melodic lines going on, and the harmonies are created from the melodic lines rather than just chords underneath.
Right.
Well, Schumann, his characteristics, and at the concerts what I do is I have a short demonstration so the audience knows how to listen to this world, because now it's a foreign world. It's first time for many people. So Schumann's tricks are this. One, he will have a chord, say C major, but somewhere in there he'll put an E flat in one of the instruments. So it makes it not quite sure whether it's a major chord or a minor chord. It's kind of like a blues chord, but a little more assertive. So that's one way he does it. Another thing he can do is he can have a C major chord and then have an E flat chord, full chord, on top of each other. That's called polytonality, when you have two keys going on at the same time. And the third way he does it in his writing is he'll have a chord that's consonant, but over that chord, there will be a melody which is occurring, or two melodies, or three. And each of those is going through different permutations of a key that are not related to the original chord. So those are the things, that's how he creates his dissonance. In other words, for Schumann, the dissonance is created through consonants. It's just throwing several consonants together at the same time.
Right. So in a way, it's a refined version of some of the things that Ives was doing by throwing things up against the wall.
Right.
It's thinking it much more through Western music history and combining things, but not saying, okay, Arnold Schoenberg tells me to use these 12 notes. I'm going to use these 12 notes that are otherwise unrelated.
Right. And you have to remember, by this time, the Schoenberg systems and Webern and Berg's music are quite well known to these composers.
Right.
But they wanted to find their own voice.
Yeah.
So this is the way many of them did it, through this unusual way. I mean, Persichetti was certainly like that as well. I think Menon also had a great deal of that. Piston certainly was the master at counterpoint.
Right.
But his writing was more of a New England conservative style. Schumann's a bit edgier.
Right.
So
even if his most famous work is probably his New England triptych. He's playing games.
Or the orchestration of America.
He's a Jewish boy from Brooklyn.
He's a Jewish boy from Brooklyn.
Like Aaron Copland.
Who grew up in Tin Pan Alley,
yes,
plugging songs.
Right.
I got to know Bill quite well.
Yeah.
And he's one of those people I genuinely miss all the time.
And what a figure. In addition to being, if he had only been a composer, an amazing figure. But, you know, Lincoln Center, the Juilliard School, the Juilliard String Quartet. I mean, he had some pretty good ideas, and he ran them pretty well.
If Aaron Copland's the dean of American music, I guess Schumann's the chancellor.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. Let's talk a little bit about France. Let's jump across the ocean here. This was your first full-time appointment in Europe, right?
No, not exactly. I had the BBC Symphony for 4 years.
Well, the continent. Let's speak of the continent. Yes. It's a different place.
Those where English isn't spoken so well. Okay. Yeah. Now, so why did I do that at this point? I love the orchestra, and the city is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Lyon is about a two-hour train ride from Paris, and you're in the heart of the cuisine that defined the world, really, when you think about it. You also have a city that's vibrant. It has aspects of being a new, modern city, mm-hmm. but it also has the traditions going back to Roman architecture. And the old city parts are just extraordinary. But I did it as part of an overall plan to simplify aspects of my life. Mm-hmm. After my heart attack, I realized I needed to make some long-range changes. And part of it had to do with the aggravation of the travel schedule. Mm-hmm. We all know it's just not a pleasant experience for the most part. And when you have to do it every week, sometimes two times a week, soloists even worse, it becomes a chore. And an aggravation is exactly the right word. And I thought, what would happen if I really took on the full-time job in Europe and the full-time job in the States? So it's 16 weeks that I do with Detroit and 14 weeks that I do in Lyon, leaving me maybe 6 or 7 weeks to do as a guest conductor in the winter season. So that was the first part of the strategy. The second part gets implemented after this summer, which is going to be my final summer of being a guest conductor. I just feel that I'd like to take the summers off for other projects that I want to do. Sure. My wife and I want to travel. Her name is Cindy McTee. She's a composer. She has things she needs to do. I want to write some more books. There's all kinds of things. As far as the actual orchestra in Lyon, it brings me back in a way because my principal conducting teacher was a Frenchman named Jean Morel at the Juilliard School. And he instilled in all of us, whether it was me, Jimmy Levine, Jim Conlon, John Nelson, Dennis Davies, he was the person who taught us this repertoire. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel uncomfortable at all going to the home of Berlioz and Ravel and so many others. But in addition to that, Morel had taught us about some of the lesser-known French composers, mm-hmm. the Pianez, Roger Ducasse, Henri Rabaud, so forth and so on. So we're able to do music that actually isn't even played in Paris at all.
Right.
So between unusual French music and the traditions that we have, it's been a joy. I've had a great time. I love the orchestra. I love the people, the city.
Characterize the orchestra for us.
So how does it differ from, say, an American orchestra?
Right.
First of all, there's the sound. Now, what makes a sound different? And it's hard to do without hearing it, but usually the sound of an orchestra is defined by its wind section more than the strings. I would say because I had background as a string player and my whole family being string players, no matter what orchestra I go to, somehow I manage to get them to sound rich and lush and all those things, kind of the way I was used to hearing it when I was a kid. The French play on French instruments, which mm-hmm. means the size of the reeds are different, the way the instrument is structured is slightly different. I would say it's a slightly lighter sound mm-hmm. than we hear from American colleagues, and certainly lighter than, say, the German orchestras or Austrian orchestras have. The French brass players also play with a little bit different kind of definition. Their sound isn't quite as direct as you have with an American brass section. They don't overwhelm at all. And sometimes I actually have to ask them to come up a little
right.
bit to be more solistic in their nature. However, what's phenomenal in France, and always has been, but never really thought of, is percussion playing in France mm-hmm. is extraordinary.
Yeah.
They really take pains over every little stroke on whatever instrument. So it's quite remarkable. And once I started doing so many of the typical French repertoire, particularly with Ravel, and I heard the sound that they produced, I now knew and understand everything my teacher was trying to tell me.
So it really is a homecoming in some ways,
in
or
a
reconnection.
In a way.
What happens if and when you try to introduce repertoire from such distant lands as, say, Germany or the United States?
Let me ask you a question back. Do you expect a Yo-Yo Ma or Rene Fleming or Josh Bell to approach all different musics in each different style as we now define them in the 21st century? The answer to that has to be a very qualified no.
Right.
And the reason for that is very simple. What makes them unique is their ability to project their own persona onto this repertoire. So what I do, and I kind of always have done, and some people like it and some don't, I'm more of, what shall we say, the Ormandy Philadelphia school. It's not that the music should all sound alike. It can't, because the music is different. But if I tried to make these kind of adjustments that some of my colleagues do, and I perfectly understand it, I wonder, well, why am I bothering? Why do I want, if I do Copland 3 in Lyon, why do I want them to sound like an American orchestra? I don't. Right. I want them to bring their touch to Copland.
Play Copland.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. It's the same thing here. If I do, I don't know, any work, Beethoven, whatever it is, I don't want them to sound like the Berlin Philharmonic. Mm-hmm. You want the CSO to sound like the CSO.
Right.
So I always try to leave that room that has the feeling of the orchestra. One time, the best example was this. I was with the Czech Philharmonic one time. We were doing Sacre du Printemps. And after the read through, a couple players came. They said, "We know you're in Chicago a lot. We love that brass sound. It's so great. How can we sound like that?" And I said, "Look, if I wanted this performance to sound like the CSO, I'd do it in Chicago.
Right.
I came here because I want that dark, vibrato-laden sound that you guys have."
Right.
So for me, it's very personal.
And I have to say, for those of you who don't have the non-existent video portion of our programming, Leonard Slatkin, who has been an enthusiastic discussant throughout this conversation and throughout his many conversations over many decades, just has been lighted up over the last 2 or 3 minutes talking about this relationship and also talking about what clearly is so important to you as a person as well as an artist, and that is that if every day were without any discovery or without any new opportunity, there are some people who would love that. You're not one of those people.
No. It's you. What's the expression I use sometimes? That if a musician ever reaches perfection, you have to stop.
Yeah.
And there cannot be such a thing, because there's always a discovery. I was great friends with Maestro Schulte. I remember coming here, he was doing the Meistersinger Overture. And there he was. The music was out there, conducting away. And we went out to dinner afterwards. I said, I'm very curious. You have to have conducted Meistersinger Overture, what, 300 times? He said, yes. And I said, so why is the music still out there? And you're turning the pages? He said, because you'll never know when you will discover something new. The other side of that, though, is that, and as I'm getting older, I actually do more and more pieces from memory or without the music in front of me, just because I feel I can communicate better to the orchestra. Mm-hmm. Because I'm afraid sometimes of that discovery, that I'll get so obsessed with it that I'll forget what I'm doing. And so I have to be a little careful sometimes. And there's a really, actually even a funnier one. It goes like this. We all know practice makes perfect. We also know nobody's perfect. Therefore, why practice?
Leonard Slatkin, it's a great pleasure to have you on Critical Thinking, and always a great pleasure to have you in Chicago and on WFMT. And again, a reminder that if you're listening to our initial broadcast of this, Monday night, April 21st, you can hear Leonard Slatkin leading the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in music of Barber, of Mason Bates, with the wonderful Anna Kiko Myers, and also the CSO premiere of the William Schumann 1N, Sixth Symphony, and An American in Paris by some fellow named Gershwin. And of course, this summer, you'll be able to hear this very exciting and very unusual program of composers who mean a lot to Leonard Slatkin and will mean a lot to you after you hear them as he makes his debut at the J. Pritzker Pavilion in Millennium Park and a homecoming to the Grant Park Orchestra. Leonard Slatkin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Music that you heard at the opening of our program tonight, Leonard Slatkin conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in concerts in early February 1986, the second movement of four, The Fugue, from William Schumann Symphony No. 3, 1941, about 6-7 years before the Sixth Symphony, which we were discussing. You can hear that Sixth Symphony, as well as music of Mason Bates, Samuel Barber, and George Gershwin, one more time with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. If you're listening to this program on Monday night, that's on Tuesday at 7:30 at Orchestra Hall. Leonard Slatkin will be at the Grant Park Music Festival July 25 and July 26. Music of Chabrier, Michel Camillo, Shostakovich, and the Polovtsian Dances of Borodin from his Prince Igor. We'd like to thank Leonard Slatkin again, as well as Leslie Carr of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Michael Hienick of Dempster Street Pro Musica, Pietro Fiumara, Matt DeStefano makes this program sound great, our funder, Alpha Wood Foundation, and other friends of this program. Drop us a line, Rentap, Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, WFMT.com/critical thinking, the home of the always free Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.